How and why is major media, including progressive, supposedly independent media, misrepresenting the realities on the ground in Syria? Does a grassroots petition drive from longtime Democracy Now! Listeners stand a chance of affecting Democracy Now!'s political coverage? How widespread is the practice of philanthropic foundations financing left-wing think tanks and media outlets? What kinds of issues get neglected or distorted as a result of foundation funding? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we take a special look at the alternative media, like Democracy Now!, their problematic coverage of the Syrian conflict, and how that may be related to the institutions that finance them. We'll hear from Vanessa Beely, a journalist who has been to Syria over the past year. We'll also hear from the author of a petition to get Democracy Now! To rethink and diversify its coverage of the situation in Syria. And we'll hear from Bob Feldman, a journalist who has exposed the known funding of the controlled left and the strategic interests that are served by such financial influence. On this week's program, Exception to the Rulers or Gatekeepers for Empire? Independent media's failed coverage of Syria. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 23rd, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On Tuesday, for the fifth time in recent weeks, U.S. warplanes attacked Syrian military targets, flagrant acts of aggression. They are part of Washington's diabolical regime change plan, at the same time testing Russia's resolve in the wake of its announced halt in cooperating with America in Syrian airspace following the downing of one of its Su-22 planes. The latest incident involved a U.S. F-15 warplane downing a Syrian drone near its border with Iraq and Jordan. A U.S.-led coalition statement lied, claiming the UAV, quote, displaced hostile intent and advanced on coalition forces, unquote. Calling naked aggression self-defense is the last refuge of a rogue state. That comes from the article, U.S. Aggression in Syria, Testing Russia's Resolve, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 21st, originally appearing at stephenlendman.org. In the wake of Sunday's U.S. shootdown of a Syrian fighter plane and the following day's warning from Russia that it will treat all American warplanes flying west of the Euphrates River as targets for its surface-to-air missiles, the threat of an armed confrontation between the world's two largest nuclear powers is now greater than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis nearly 55 years ago. This threat, which carries with it the grim prospect of the annihilation of humanity, is the product of a calculated escalation on the part of U.S. imperialism. The downing of the Syrian fighter marked the first time in this century that a U.S. warplane has shot down the plane of another country. The last instance of such aerial combat took place in 1999 during the U.S.-NATO war against Serbia, when an American fighter plane shot down a Serbian MIG. The gravity of the event was underscored Tuesday with Australia's announcement that it is grounding its planes that have been flying over Syria. That comes from the article, The U.S. Escalation in Syria and the Threat of World War, by Bill Van Auken, posted June 21st, originally appearing at World Socialist website. Russia and Iran are in Syria legally, invited there by an elected government. The Americans are there uninvited as war criminals. Under international law, established by the Americans themselves, it is a war crime to initiate aggression against a country that has not raised a fist against you. So, to be in Syria, Washington has to pretend to be quote-unquote fighting terrorism rather than supporting it. The lie has been given to this claim many times, but now that an American pilot has proven that the U.S. is in Syria to support its agent, ISIS, not even a Megyn Kelly prostitute can honestly claim to believe that Washington is fighting ISIS. That comes from the article, Another Step Toward a Devastating War, Washington's Pretense That It Is Fighting ISIS, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted June 21st. The situation escalates in Syria following the U.S. aviation attack against an Su-22 belonging to the country's National Air Force. The Russian Defense Ministry said that the U.S. move may be considered an quote-unquote act of aggression and announced that it is halting all interactions with the U.S. within the framework on the Memorandum of Incident Prevention in Syrian skies. Now, Russian missile defenses will track any U.S.-led coalition aircraft west of the Euphrates River. In areas where Russian aviation is conducting combat missions in the Syrian skies, any flying objects, including jets and unmanned aerial vehicles of the International Coalition discovered west of the Euphrates River, will be followed by Russian air and ground defenses as air targets, the ministry announced. At the same time, the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF, also joined the blame game by attempting to justify the act of aggression. That comes from a report under the headline, Video, Military Escalation in Syria Towards U.S.-Russia Confrontation, by South Front, posted June 21st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Vanessa Beely is an independent researcher, writer, and photographer. She is reported from Syria since July of 2016. She's met with religious leaders, government ministers, unarmed opposition members, Syria NGOs, and humanitarian institutions in the field. She writes for and is an associate editor for 21st Century Wire. She's a special contributor at Mint Press in the U.S. and at the U.K. Column Daily News Channel. And her work is republished at Global Research, among other online media outlets. So, Vanessa Beely, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
Could I ask you, first of all, at what point you discovered that there were glaring distortions of the facts on the ground? I mean, what really stood out for you originally about the way the media was reporting the conflict erroneously?
Actually, that's a really interesting question, because I think my first awakening to there being something wrong was actually when I was in Gaza in 2013, and I'd been there during the 2012 Israeli bombing. I had then left and then came back in April 2013. So to some extent, I was only following Syria on the periphery of the Palestinian issue. But at that time, that Israel bombed Damascus. And I had a conversation. I'd already started to read reports about the fact that arms were being brought into the militant and extremist factions. They were being supplied by the United States, by the NATO states, and by the Gulf states. So I had already started sort of picking that apart. And as a result of that bombing, I actually interviewed a Hamas spokesperson in Gaza. And what I was horrified by was his response when I asked him about the bombing of Damascus by Israel, bearing in mind Syria's traditional and historic role as a close ally of the Palestinian cause. His response was, well, it's perfectly understandable because Syria has crossed Israel's red line by supplying arms to Hezbollah. Now, at this point, my jaw just hit the floor, because here was a spokesperson for Palestinian resistance, as it is portrayed, telling me that it was kind of okay for Israel to have bombed Syria's territory because Syria was crossing Israel's red line by supplying arms to the resistance arm that had grown out, actually, of many of the Palestinian refugees that had fled Palestine during the Israeli ethnic cleansing, the Nakba in 1948, and who had settled in Zabadani, a region of Syria, and from whence had grown this organization with its sole purpose to be to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And yet here was a resistance member telling me that it was kind of okay for Israel to have directly bombed Damascus. So that sort of set, you know, that set my mind in motion as to the fact that there was something very, very obviously wrong here. Then I got involved as a result of having met her in Gaza with Ava Bartlett, who had at the time founded the Syria Solidarity Movement. And really, it sort of spiraled from there. And my interest grew. I started to investigate what was happening. I saw the correlations between what was happening in Syria and what had happened in Iraq and in Libya. And then in around 2015, I'd sort of got very interested in the organization, the White Helmets. Mm-hmm. And so all of this sort of coincided. It's very difficult to pin down exactly what the event was, but I would say almost certainly it was the bombing of Damascus that really sort of propelled me into investigating what was going on in Syria.
Talk about the White Helmets. I know that you've done a lot of research on this, original research. Maybe some of the listening audience might be familiar with them from that documentary award they won, the documentary about them that won an award last March. I don't know what it was, the Leni Riefenstahl Award? I don't know. But
The Oscar,
that must have, yeah, they won. Same thing.
I mean, come on, let's not.
Anyway, I'm sure that drove you up the wall. But please explain to our listeners what you uncovered about this group, how they're financed, what they're doing before arriving in Syria.
Oh, right. I mean, this is, I always say before I start, and I will try to not draw breath. It's very hard to condense the very insidious roots and purpose of this organization. But let's try and keep it relatively simple. My first article was written about them towards the last quarter of 2015, but I had been looking into them prior to that. Corey Morningstar, who is another author that I would recommend people to read as regards her expertise on the soft power complex, on the NGO complex, had already started to highlight who they were even back as far as 2014 and their relations to Avaaz, to Purpose, which is a Manhattan PR agency, and right back to the Democratic MoveOn.org, which of course was created to sort of try and distract people from Bill Clinton's extramarital activity. So the connections to sort of United States soft power organizations and foundations is very clear. But what became very clear to me when I started to look into them was the huge role that the British government and the British intelligence organizations were playing in the creation of this organization, which I believe to have, let's say, a three-way purpose in Syria, and I'll explain that as I go on. But the money for funding this organization comes from NATO and Gulf states, from primarily the United States via USAID, which of course was set up in 1966 pretty much by the CIA as an outreach infiltration agent for US neocolonialism. USAID fund the White Helmets through Chemonix, which is one of their major facilitators and partners globally. But the UK Foreign Office, under the Conflict Stability and Security Fund, has probably, we think, funneled around £65 million into the White Helmets since 2013. Overall, in the region of an estimated, it's quite hard to work out exactly how much money has gone in, but we conservatively estimate around £250 million has come in from EU states, the UK, the US, Japan, Qatar, and various Syrian opposition groups. Known all of these nations funding them have a vested and publicly declared interest in regime change in Syria. So the very fact that the White Helmets are claiming to be a non-governmental organization, the fact that they publicly state they have no affiliation with a party that has any political or other interest inside Syria is illegitimate. Mm. Okay, that's number one. But then let's look at who created this organization. It was created in 2013, not in Syria, in Turkey. It was created by a British ex-military private security expert with connections. He didn't work for Blackwater, but he moves in a very close circle affiliated to Blackwater, who, of course, were famous for the Nisra Square massacre in Iraq, and who have been funded both by the Bush regime and by the Obama regime. Obama gave them $250 million at least to continue CIA outreach, assassinations and operations, right, to disassociate the U.S. administration from what was happening. So James Lemessurier set up the White Helmets in Turkey. Now, what is very important to note here is that there is an existing Syria civil defense. The real Syria civil defense was established inside Syria in 1953. It is the only recognized Syria civil defense by the International Civil Defense Organization based in Geneva that is affiliated with the UN, with the World Health Organization, and the Red Cross. It was set up, as I said, in Syria by Syrians. It comprises of Syrians from all sects, all religions, all cultures inside Syria. So it represents the secular society of Syria. This organization operates in 80% of the inhabited areas of Syria currently. So it's servicing a conservatively estimated 80% of the Syrian population. The White Helmets, on the other hand, that if we remember were created in Turkey, not in Syria, are operating in around 20% of the inhabited areas of Syria. And that's a very that's a very generous estimate, actually. Majority now that they've actually evacuated from East Aleppo are now in Idlib, and we know that they've now appeared in Dara in the south, close to the Israeli annexed area of Syria, the Golan Heights. The White Helmets only operate in areas that are under the control of either Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda, or ISIS, or any of the other U.S. NATO state and Gulf state funded extremist factions, including Ra'al Sham, that have carried out ethnic cleansing atrocities across Syria, Nour al-Din Zinki, who beheaded the 12-year-old Palestinian child Abdullah Issa in July 2016, and many other various splinter groups that still operate under the leadership and the superior fighting power of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but majority Al-Qaeda. So that's a very important point to make. My experience in East Aleppo, I was in East Aleppo during its liberation in December 2016. So I was basically, I had the privilege of being able to enter the districts literally hours after the Syrian Arab Army had liberated them from Nusra Front-led occupation and brutal occupancy. Now, when I spoke to the civilians in those districts of East Aleppo who had been under this terrorist occupation for almost 5 years, and I asked them who the White Helmets were, the majority of them didn't recognize the term White Helmets. When I asked who the civil defense were, they all described them as Nusra Front civil defense, so Al-Qaeda civil defense. We were told time and time again that the White Helmets did not recognize civilians. Did not rescue civilians. Actually, they stole from injured civilians and left them under the rubble to die. That was a regular statement that we heard from these civilians who were basically emerging from terrorist rule into the safety of the government-held West Aleppo. That's number one. Number two is when I went back to Syria in April, May, so 4 months after the liberation of Aleppo. And I went back and I spoke to the various civilians, families, children, people who'd returned to the East Aleppo districts. And I was able to get into the abandoned White Helmet centers, because, as I mentioned, the White Helmets didn't stay behind to help civilians. They left with Al-Qaeda, Nusra Front, Ar-al-Sham, and all the other terrorist factions to Idlib when East Aleppo was liberated and when the government, under the reconciliation and amnesty agreement, allowed the armed militants to leave and to go under safely to Idlib. The White Helmets went with them.
I wanted to get you to bring up one particular incident, which strikes me as being one of the more devastating over the course of this conflict, sure. And that was the bus bombing in the Rashidin massacre. Yeah. And I've seen very little of reporting on this from the Western media. I mean, I looked at Democracy Now, and the only entry they have is the headline, Syria, from April 17th, Syria, 126 civilians killed in bombing on evacuation bus. And it reads, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says at least 126 people were killed, including 68 children, in a bomb attack targeting a convoy of buses filled with civilians being evacuated from besieged government-held areas near Aleppo. That's the only reference to this that you'll find anywhere on Democracy Now! Website. You were there hours after it happened. So
I mean, I did the same as you. I actually checked on Democracy Now!'s reporting this afternoon, and I was horrified to see that. CNN described it as a hiccup. The UK Telegraph described the 116 children that were blown apart by a suicide bomber as government supporters. They later edited that article and took that phrase out after I outed it on Russia Today. But the media response to this massacre, which for me was just one of the most horrendous crimes of this entire conflict, was appalling. And for Democracy Now! To sort of almost airbrush those lives, those children's lives, and to airbrush the entire story as they did is borderline criminal. To try and give you a very brief summary of what actually happened and of the White Helmet role in what happened. These civilians, I think around 5,000 of them, were being evacuated from the predominantly, or the Shia villages of Kafrai and Fua in Idlib. Now, these villages had been under siege, full siege, for 2 years and partial siege for around 4 years. During that siege, they had been shelled and sniped. They had been starved. They had been deprived of humanitarian aid, being besieged by Nusra Front and Ar-al-Sham, again, NATO and Gulf state-funded and armed terrorist factions in Syria. Now, during that entire time, they had never been mentioned in mainstream media. Equally this time, these 5,000 civilians left Kafrayin Fura under an exchange deal that the government had set up with Madaya, a city to the south of Damascus. And basically, what was a journey that should have taken 46 minutes took them hours, because the terrorists forced them to drive through villages where they were threatened, where they were menaced, and where they were basically threatened with attack for the whole journey. So they arrived then in Rashidin. Rashidin is an area to the south of Aleppo that is under control still of Nusra Front and Ar-al-Sham. So they arrived in a hostile area. The White Helmets, we were told, were also there. So they were still operating alongside Nusra Front and Ar-al-Sham. And prior to the arrival of these civilians, the White Helmets had been demonstrating against the evacuation, calling them infidels, calling them apostates. So they arrived in Rashidin. They were kept on the buses. They were not allowed to have water or food. And then I think on the second day of them being there, in the morning, somebody arrived with a bag of chips, and the children were allowed off. And of course, having been deprived for effectively 2 years, the children ran after the chips. And were given the chips to eat. Then they were put back on the buses, and they were locked back on the buses. 10 minutes before the actual explosion, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent were told to leave. Four Turkish ambulances arrived and parked up. This was all based on witness testimony. And then the truck arrived with the chips. The children were again enticed off the buses. And as they ran after the food, the truck exploded. So we were told quite clearly by the mothers, by the bus drivers, that this was pre-planned. It was a deliberate massacre of the children of these civilians from Kafraya and Fur. We were then also told by numerous witnesses that after the explosion, the mothers were allowed off the buses to get to their children, but they were only allowed off for 10 minutes. So they didn't actually have the time to get to their children to help their injured and dying children because they were filmed by the White Helmets. And this, again, was a testimony that was given by more than three or four. This was given by everybody that we spoke to, from the drivers, from the mothers, from the relatives, from the uncles, from the fathers. Then they were pushed back on the buses and they were locked inside the buses. So try to imagine how this must have felt. They were allowed off. They were not allowed to reach their dying children. They were put back on the buses and they were locked in and held there at gunpoint, while the White Helmets, Nusra Front and Arar Sham fighters, put their children in trucks. So the dead children, the dying children, the injured children, the traumatized children were piled into the back of pickup trucks. They were piled into the back of the Turkish ambulances and they were abducted from Rashdin. They were taken to Turkey, not to Aleppo, which was 15 minutes away, the closest hospital, Al-Razi. They were taken to Turkey. Why? And why was this not reported? Why was this not mentioned by the mainstream media?
Or the so-called independent media, Democracy Now in particular, have they made any attempts to reach out to you? And have you been, how has that correspondence gone?
Yeah, in December 2016, I was contacted via an intermediary by Laura Gottesteiner, one of the producers at Democracy Now. And the suggestion had been that they should talk to myself and Ava Bartlett, as we had both just returned from Aleppo, but particularly about my research on the White Helmets. Now, basically, their reply was, I appeared to be the only person reporting on the White Helmets. And so, therefore, I was fundamentally discredited as a conspiracy theorist. And they continued with their White Helmet narratives. So they gave no platform to a diverging view. Now, this is bearing in mind that yesterday, footage was released of a White Helmet operative in Dara actually assisting with the slaughter of Syrian Arab Army prisoners of war and alongside extremists that were holding up severed heads of the Syrian Arab Army soldiers as trophies of war. So this is the organization that Democracy Now! Has given a platform for, that mainstream media has given a platform to, and that Democracy Now! Has not once entertained a diverging view or entertained the views of people who have actually been on the ground in Syria and who have spoken to the Syrian people who are living under US-EU sanctions and under EU-US proxy terrorists intervention inside Syria.
Vanessa Bealey, I really want to thank you for this, providing us with these perspectives, and thank you for your ongoing and very heroic reporting from Syria.
Thank you.
We've been joined by independent researcher, writer, and photographer Vanessa Bealey. She's an associate editor and contributor to 21st Century Wire. If you wish to look at her reporting, just go to 21stcenturywire.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Since mid-April, an open letter critical of Democracy Now!'s coverage of the Syria conflict has been circulating over the internet. It was sent on behalf of the group East Bay Veterans for Peace Chapter 162, representing Berkeley and the surrounding region. The author of the letter was Daniel Borgstrom. In the 1960s, he'd enlisted as a GI and served in Vietnam. Following his discharge, he encountered anti-war sentiment and eventually got converted to that point of view. He participated in numerous actions over the years. He wrote for underground newspapers and eventually got engaged in the Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley. He became an intense fan of Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman, and remains a fan. The open letter and a follow-up petition is calling on Democracy Now! To diversify its coverage. A printed copy of the letter has been distributed to stops along Amy Goodman's 20th anniversary tour. According to Borgstrom, 2 months after the letter was sent to Democracy Now!, it has yet to receive an official response. The Global Research NewsHour caught up with Daniel Borgstrom in early June to get a better understanding of his petition targeting Democracy Now!
I like Amy Goodman's show. I'm a fan of it. But I'm really disappointed at how she's been covering this stuff, particularly in Syria. So many of these accusations that are being thrown around today, you know, Russia did it, Assad did it. Where's the evidence? I don't see evidence. Amy Goodman does have good people on it. Like one day she had a couple of very good journalist and Jonathan Steele, very good. And then there was a professor, Stephen Cohen. That was just a couple of days before we mailed our letter, our open letter. And then what does she do? She comes back about 4 weeks later and has some guy on there who's refuting these. She plays what they have said and refutes them, but without evidence, of course. Without evidence, just refutes them, and does not have either Jonathan Steele or Professor Stephen Cohen on there to defend their views. I thought that was pretty disgusting.
Is that the interview with Anand Gopal?
Yes, exactly. And I think that was on May 3rd, if I remember correctly.
It seems to me that Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman are highly revered among progressive political circles. I'm wondering if you ran into any resistance or criticism from other progressive-minded people.
When we went out there to leaflet, people said, well, you're going to run into these fanatical Amy fans, and they're going to do whatever awful things to you. No, that didn't happen. Just the opposite. The people we have run into were very receptive to this letter. Actually, have not gotten any hate mail, have not gotten any bad responses, actually.
In what other ways, besides the slanted coverage of the Syrian conflict, is Goodman's show failing its progressive listener base?
Well, in this endless Trump bashing, she needs to go behind the story of what's this campaign against Trump all about. And it's true he's a bad guy, but why does the neoliberal establishment hate him so much? I think she should be pointing out that it is a campaign by the neoliberal establishment. She doesn't quite come out as heavy as the mainstream media on saying that Russia hacked the election, but she kind of lets it slide by. Last November, I think it was on Thanksgiving Day, December 24th, the Washington Post published an article based on something by an outfit called Prop or Not. Those people are running a campaign against websites which are an alternate source of media. And that's what needs to be defended. She is not defending them. She is lining up with corporate media, with MSM. And time after time, I hear her quoting this an article in the Washington Post said such and such. I hear it time again, and I'm not against quoting the Washington Post or anything else. I'm not against that, but the way she does it, time after time, she never points out that they also promote fake news. She seems to want to have it both ways, that she's a progressive and yet at the same time that she's in line with Washington Post, New York Times, and those. I think that those papers need to be exposed. And it isn't just things they've done recently. They have those papers going way back to the 1940s. They worked together with an operation called Operation Mockingbird, which was a CIA operation. The Washington Post, as well as the New York Times, worked hand in glove with the CIA. This came out in, during the Church Committee investigation. I think it was 1975, 1976, maybe also into 77. It was in the mid-70s. It was written up in an article by Carl Bernstein, of Watergate fame.
Okay. I was wondering then, how you make sense of Democracy Now, this long-running program, and how you make sense of its perceived failures to responsibly cover Syria, proper not, and other stories. Are you saying that Democracy Now is part of this Operation Mockingbird, or is there some other psychological or other apparatus at work there?
Well, I frankly don't know. But it appears that Amy is getting funding from foundations. That's what it appears to me. What I do notice is that her show is broadcast on PBS, and I would guess. It seems to me that if you want to get on PBS, you have to. There's certain things you can't say. There's a certain party line that you have to go along with.
Okay.
And that's what I see. Now, I don't know how deep she is into this. I would like to think that she is. I'm optimistic that she would wake up and see what she's doing, and enough people speak out to her, say, "Hey, Amy, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing?" Call her back from the cliff, you know. So I'm hoping that she will wake up. I can't be certain.
Following this interview, on June 20th, 2017, the Global Research News Hour sent an email to Democracy Now! Requesting answers to questions about the limited focus of the program's Syria coverage. No response to the email has been forthcoming as of the time the show goes to air. We've been discussing the way that not only mainstream corporate media, but also so-called progressive independent media have been distorting the picture of what's going on in Syria. And we've been using the highly regarded daily news program Democracy Now! As something of a case study. With rare exceptions, Democracy Now! Seems to be upholding the imperialist narrative while ignoring reportage and analysis pointing to terrorist groups receiving backing from the West as the principal cause of suffering of the Syrian people currently. There are indications that part of the reason for this distorted coverage springs from the role of private foundations in providing funding for the human and corporate infrastructure behind these progressive outlets. One of the people pioneering this disturbing research is Bob Feldman. Bob Feldman is an independent journalist and the author of a 2007 paper, Report from the Field, Left Media and Left Think Tanks, Foundation-Managed Protest, which appeared in the online journal Critical Sociology. Previously, he collaborated with journalist Brian Salter on a string of articles on the left gatekeeper phenomenon, formerly on the website questionsquestions.net. He joins us now from Boston to discuss this subject. So, Bob Feldman, welcome to the Global Research News Hour radio program.
Hi, yeah, it's good to be here. Like you mentioned, the the coverage of Syria on Democracy Now. Coincidentally, the Tides Foundation in 2016 gave over $300,000 in grants to help fund Democracy Now! Productions Incorporated. And a board member of the Tides Foundation and Tides Center is the former Assistant Secretary of State, Suzanne Nosel, in the Clinton, under Hillary Clinton in the Obama administration. And she's been somebody who's helped push the concept of, quote, humanitarian military intervention. Others people call it humanitarian militarism by the U.S. Government. And currently she's, after having moved from the State Department to the position of Executive Director of Amnesty International New York, she then moved from Amnesty International New York, or USA rather, to the Penn Center, which talks about censorship abroad and human rights violations abroad, although it doesn't really talk about censorship in the alternative media world of journalists who have done investigations on things like what happened on September 11th, 2001, people who are baited as conspiracy theorists.
That was always very interesting to me. And you know, Bob, like if right-wing foundations were discovered to be sponsoring think tanks or media promoting the fossil fuel industry, for instance, I'm sure that most on the left would quickly point out how that funding corrupts their objectivity. But I'm not hearing much criticism of left groups and left media, which have similarly benefited from those liberal foundations. Could you tell us a little bit more about some of those foundations? I mean, you mentioned Tides, but what other critical foundations are we talking about?
You know, since I wrote that critical sociology article for the last 10 years, the biggest funder of Democracy Now! Has been the Lannan Foundation. It's based in New Mexico. Lannan Foundation has, in 2017, it gave a $30,000 grant to Democracy Now!, 2016, $30,000 grant. But in 2014, it's given two grants totaling $450,000 for Democracy Now!. 2015, it gave two grants totaling $400,000. So you're talking over $1 million in grants. I mean, Democracy Now! Has a budget of $8 million a year in revenues. Its revenues exceeded in the fiscal year 2015 its expenditures by $1.6 million, even though it's supposed to be a nonprofit, Democracy Now! But the Lannan Foundation is interesting because it was founded by the largest stockholder of AT&T, which played a role in the overthrow of Allende in 1973. The largest stockholder of AT&T at that time was J. Patrick Lannan, the father of the current head of the Lannan Foundation. But none of that history is likely to be presented on Democracy Now! Other foundations are the Park Foundation, $25,000 grant in 2015, $1,000 grant in 2016, $30,000 in 2016, and then Glazer Progress Fund gives $30,000 each year, and it adds up,
I'm very particularly curious about the Ford Foundation, because there's a history going back to the McCarthy era. And I'm wondering if you could just maybe mention, maybe in a hopefully a succinct but penetrating way, about Ford Foundation's history and connections with the CIA.
Yeah. The Ford Foundation was used by the CIA as a conduit, to fund various groups after World War II who were seen as a counter to those groups that would oppose U.S. militarism abroad. The use of the Ford Foundation came out in, you know, in the 1960s. Ramparts Magazine, which was a muckraking magazine, revealed the use of these foundations, and that was one of the, and the thing about the Ford Foundation is that until the late 80s and 90s, it didn't fund left-wing groups in the United States that were challenging U.S. militarism. But in 1967, McGeorge Bundy, who'd been one of the architects of the Vietnam War escalation in the Johnson White House, he was named Ford Foundation president. He then said, well, it's better to have groups under our umbrella. And at first, the liberal groups were funded, especially in the African American civil rights groups were funded by the Ford Foundation. Then later, by the time of the 1980s, 90s, the successor to Bundy and the Ford Foundation began funding the alternative media groups. And Democracy Now!, for instance, in 98, when it was starting, got a $75,000 grant from the Ford Foundation. And the thing about the Ford Foundation is that it's the idea is to create what we call a parallel left, something that appears to be leftist and is leftist in terms of the rhetoric, but omits certain issues, doesn't criticize the foundations themselves that fund them, doesn't talk about the degree to which the Ford Foundation, which is multi-$1 billion, invests in various corporations that the left fights against and that the anti-war movement has fought against. And at the same time, by funding a parallel left alternative media, a set of groups, stable of groups, those groups then will exclude certain people who are going to criticize the foundation, who are going to raise questions about things like 9/11. And this whole concept of the parallel left, the same thing happened in terms of aspects of the women's liberation movement. In fact, Gloria Steinem used to be, worked for a CIA-funded foundation, and then before 1967, that would go to international conferences and try to recruit people and try to present an alternative vision to what the radical left was presenting. So there's a use of foundation, because whoever has, if you have money behind you, like Democracy Now!, you can be on 1,400 stations around the world. Whereas groups that don't have money and don't get subsidized and just have to rely on listener sponsors only, they don't have that kind of capacity. And the idea is, once a grant is given, if Bill Moyers gives you a grant, if his foundation gives you $100,000, then you're less likely to allow critics of Bill Moyers' history in being in the Johnson White House that intervened in the Dominican Republic in 1965, you know, things like that.
So you're talking about basically it's a way of putting more of an emphasis on like a shot of adrenaline to these left formations that don't actually pose a threat to state power, just the ones that they can live with, I suppose, so that you have that appearance.
Yeah, look at the example of, in the 21st century, we're in this era of permanent war. We could go over the atrocities that I'm sure your station reports on every day, and then even the atrocities are reported to a degree on some of the parallel left and some of the alternative media there, groups that are subsidized. But the thing is, if Democracy Now! Is, for instance, is on the show, is on the radio station 5 days a week in Winnipeg, and I don't know how many days of the week is your show, Global Research News, shows
once.
On. Once. So that creates an imbalance. And so the people, you know, and so the thing is, the lack of financial transparency is also that of these groups also enables them to get off the hook for being held accountable by the listeners and by movement activists. Because if people don't know that hundreds of thousands of dollars are going to these alternative media groups, and that, you know, then they're less likely to challenge them about, well, why are you accepting this money? Why aren't you allowing critics of these foundations to get on? And at the same time, it also explains lack of financial the finances can often help explain why certain voices have been excluded. I mean, in the 21st century, the biggest exclusion has been those who have been labeled conspiracy theorists. And conspiracy theorist is anybody who questions the official story on certain key issues, like on 9/11. You know, and then if once you're labeled a conspiracy theorist, then you don't get on, you're not invited to be guests on a show like Democracy Now. You know, once in a while, they might invite somebody, but still on the day-to-day, you know, course of events, certain issues are off limits, you know.
Well, I'm just gonna try to challenge you a little bit, at least for the sake of skeptical listeners.
Yeah, right.
Many of the individuals representing those left media and think tank groups, they'll deny that these foundations are influencing their content, you know, and or telling them what to say, and that may well be true. But like at the same time, I mean, you might find, you know, corporate sponsored newspapers don't have to wait for a specific statement from their advertisers to tell them what to publish.
Right.
But, you know,
right.
I guess essentially the same dynamic that we're seeing with these foundation grants?
Well, yeah, it's called self-censorship, you know. In other words, as Bill Moyers' son once told me in an email letter, you know, he said, if, you know, because his group was also getting funding, he says, well, if the funders don't like what we're doing, they don't fund us afterwards. And so what happens is that a lot of Lennon Foundation will keep giving the money as long as they're not criticized. In practice, what happens is that if Democracy Now all of a sudden started to talk about the history of the Lennon family's investment in ITT in Chile, and you know, or made a crusade against their funders, they don't get the funding the next year. It's each year by year, and so this the main thing is the self censorship, because they will always deny the grant, the people who get the grants and who have these shows will always deny, well, we're not controlled by them, but. I know one time I was on a show and I was talking with on a radio show. This is in the 1990s when I wrote for Downtown Alternative Weekly, and I started criticizing how Bill Moyers, well, you know, in terms of his history in the Johnson White House, and then a newspaper in New York City was going to be inherited by somebody who actually was a leftist, but then the father of the guy, who was Guggenheim, of the Guggenheim Foundation, gave it to Bill Moyers when he was young. So when I started talking about that, then immediately the fellow who was being funded by Bill Moyers Schumann Foundation, without revealing that he was funding, started saying, "Oh no, Bill Moyers is a great guy." And the thing is, Bill Moyers has done some good work. No denying that. A lot of these people have done good work. But the thing is that there's this hidden financial connection thing that people have to know about. There should be financial transparency, you know, so that way one can know, you know, whether the self-censorship mechanism is going on there. But that's the main thing, that they don't have to issue an order saying don't cover this, don't cover that. But each year when they fill out the grant requests, the program managers and the boards of these trustees will look at which ones they want to approve, which ones they don't want to approve. And, you know, $7 million of Democracy Now's funding is coming from contributions and grants, but since they're not listing the sums of money, listeners and viewers don't really know what percentage of those contributions are coming from individuals, what percentage are coming from foundations, and how large they are. Mm.
Bob Feldman, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to give you a chance to maybe, as somebody who's studied this gatekeeper phenomenon for over a decade now, close to two decades, do you have advice for our listenership as to how they can get at the truth of the matter when the media they have come to trust may be misleading them, as you've written and spoken about?
Well, I think with the internet, I mean, there's certain sites like Global Research News, people could keep checking. But I think the thing is, it's the problem now. I think a lot of people know what's going on. They know the limitations of alternative media. I mean, you saw even questioning the 9/11 thing. But it's more that they don't realize that the parallel alternative media, the parallel left, that's omitting information, that has to be confronted as well. You know, I mean, people have to mobilize and realize that it's not just the alternative media. I mean, essentially, I think people have to, in order to get a distribution system, people have to march on the corporate media, march on the alternative media, occupy media studios just like they occupied universities, and then and protest against the exclusion of authentic anti-war voices. But people used to say, we don't want to see movement superstars, we don't want to see individual cult of personalities. Yet you have a situation we have with these tenured, well-paid alternative media celebrities are blocking the growth of the movement in this country by omitting certain key information. I mean, you can't understand history without understanding how the foundations are funding NGOs. You can't yet if you have an alternative media that doesn't look at the NGO funding structure, how are you going to change the world in a revolutionary direction, you know?
Hmm. Bob Feldman, I'm pleased to have finally connected with you. I thank you for all the research that you've done and sharing it with us. I hope we can speak again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks.
Yeah, we're glad, and keep up the work of trying to break through the, whatever we might call it, the foundation curtain,
Okay.
Okay, take care.
Okay, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Bob Feldman. He is a researcher, investigative journalist, author of the Where's the Change blog, available at wherechangeobama.blogspot.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.